hello and welcome again to another episode of Radio Lisa, and today I'm very happy to welcome Miss Sandra Brandstetter, a former student of Lisa, and she graduated back in the year 2014 and is currently working for her doctorate degree, her PhD in quantum physics at the University of Heidelberg, and we spent almost a full hour in conversation with her. We talked about all sorts of different things about life after school and also a lot about physics. And in our conversation, we also have Mrs. Bettina Steinhauser, our history teacher, Miss Ruth Brown, our physics teacher, and also Andrew Funk, our math teacher. And of course, I'm a self-biology teacher, Oliver Kim. And we had a very interesting discussion that we'd like to share with you now. So let's get started.
Hallo, Sandra.
Hi.
Hallo. Welcome back.
Yeah, super nice to be here.
Yeah. When did you graduate from our school, from Lisa?
2014. So May 2014, yeah.
Yeah. And what are you doing right now?
So right after graduation, I went to Innsbruck and studied physics in Innsbruck. And now I'm doing my PhD in experimental quantum physics, actually, at the University of Heidelberg.
Heidelberg. Okay. So, and you completed the österreichische Matura und das Abi-Diploma.
Yes, I did both
okay. of them, yeah. I remember that you were already quite interested in physics while you were here. And basically, you applied at the Universität Innsbruck. You just studied there for a few years.
Exactly, yeah.
Did your Magister?
My Master of Science.
Master of Science. And what was your topic? What did you research?
I'm still doing the same stuff. It's actually ultra-cold quantum gases. So you take...
Ultra-cold quantum gases.
Yes, it's quite a mouthful. So what you do is you basically cool atoms down to a millionth of a degree above the absolute zero.
Mm-hmm.
And then they start to basically, quantum phenomena start to emerge. So usually you have the problem with quantum stuff that it's super small and that you can't look at it. But with this, you then get like a super, super, super large quantum, super large, still a micron, but it's larger than a nanometer. So you can resolve it and you can just take picture of your quantum object if you just cool down stuff crazily low. With lasers, by the way.
So, and how many people actually started to study physics in Innsbruck? Were there a lot of people?
Yes, so I think we started out, I would have to guess, but I would say we started out with like 80 to 100 people studying physics.
Okay.
And at Christmas we were at 40 people.
Uh-huh. They stopped?
They stopped, yes.
Uh-huh, okay. And how long did you study? 5 years in total or six?
So I did my bachelor in 4 years. No, 3 years. Three years, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then my master, I took 2.5 years. So I took one additional term. But
How long are you now doing your PhD? How long are you now in Heidelberg?
For 2 years.
2 years.
So
okay.
I started in July 2020.
And when do you expect to finish, hopefully?
My professor said October 23, but I don't believe him yet.
And then, of course, a postdoc?
Yes, I'm actually thinking about doing a postdoc, yes.
Okay, yeah.
The nice thing is that at the moment, the job market for physicists is quite relaxed, so you can just say, okay, I'm doing a postdoc now, and then still go to industry afterwards, because you're just hired right away. It's super nice.
Yeah. So you've been away from school now since 2014, which is 8 years. Thinking back 8 years, what advice would you give your former self? Imagine that you're now, I don't know, turn back time 10 years. So what advice would you give yourself?
That's actually a super nice question. I think it's not worrying too much about the fact that you maybe can't do physics in the IB because of course schedules, because actually I won't say it doesn't matter, but it's not as important. It's rather important that you have really, I think school is really the time to get like broad knowledge of a lot of subjects. So, and then you can focus up afterwards. I think this is really one of the most important things, that you shouldn't start crazy focus in school already, because I think school really gives you the time to open up your perspective, and then afterwards you can still take the time and focus on whatever you want to do.
But I think for you it was already quite clear very early on that you were wanted to go into physics, right?
Yes,
took IP physics as well?
No, I didn't, because we didn't have enough people to get the course together.
Okay, I see. Uh-huh.
So I took math higher level and chemistry standard level.
Okay. But it was clear for you that you wanted to go into physics.
Yes.
I remember that this was already an interest that you had quite early on.
Yeah. So I think this was quite clear from like second grade or something like this.
Quite interesting, yeah.
And there was a strange math teacher as well at some point in time.
So this is Mr. Mr. Andrew Funk, and you were?
I was homeroom teacher and math teacher and music teacher, and just hope I didn't get into anyone's way, because mathematicians and physicists are always closely related but at war with each other. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't
get any of that or take any of that along from school, or could you just leave it behind?
So I have to say, I mean, I think it strongly depends what you study, but so for me, like the math knowledge that I gained in school, this was quite good for the first 2 weeks, and it was super nice to have this in the first 2 weeks, because then you could really, like, you had a head start, but the head start didn't go too long. But I think this is actually an advantage. So I mean, also taking math higher level, the head start was gone in 2 weeks, but I think this is actually an advantage, because I know some people who did more technical stuff first, and they completely underestimated the physics stuff, because they knew a lot of the mechanics that you do in first semester, they already knew. And then they were like, I don't have to study this. And this is something that's super, super dangerous. So you shouldn't believe that you don't have to study it because you learned it in school already. Because they then basically, they lost the point where they had to start to study. But so for me, it was super nice. I had a head start for 2 weeks, which is anyway the time where everything is crazy at university. But then you notice that you have to study along, and then it's fine again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also heard this, that sometimes if you have it too easy at the beginning, then you don't get used to studying.
Yeah.
And then you can fall behind quite quickly, because the material at the university progresses so fast and so quickly that the initial head start that you have. I've heard this also for people who studied mechanical engineering, Maschinenbau, and who went to a HTL before. Of course they have an advantage. But apparently, from what I heard, is this advantage kind of is gone.
Yep.
Fairly soon. Huh?
But I think the advantage that you never lose is the way of working that you learn in school. And I think this is maybe the much more important stuff than the actual content of the subjects, but how you work on stuff. And I think there also the IB is quite nice, that you really have to find some topics yourself for your research stuff that you have to do for these internal assessments. You have to work independently, and I think this is really, that's the advantage you never lose.
Mm-hmm.
Also with presentations and stuff like this, I know people who can't do proper presentations in their masters, because at university no one will teach you to do a presentation. You are expected to know how to do a presentation, and that's it. And if you can't do it, well,
tough luck, huh?
Tough luck. But I think that's really the most important thing that you take. The content itself, well,
I do gather that the IB diploma did help you in that way, that writing the extended essay and writing the internal assessments, in your case in chemistry,
and also in math and stuff like this, where you really had to think about what you want to research and where you want to spend your time on. I think this is really the strong advantage that you take. And I have to admit, I totally underestimated the importance of the creativity, action and social service hours, because this is important, because somehow at university you're only doing physics all day, and in school you have your nice range of subjects, you have to do some gym in the afternoon, you have to do some arts, whatever. At university you don't, you have physics all day, and you have to get your creative and social outlet, you have to find it yourself. And this is something,
do you have to, you're with your heart and mind, you're a physicist, you want to spend time in the lab as much as you can, you're right, and
yes,
that's the contents of your life. Come on, why do you need to have all of those other outlets?
Because the hours, and I mean, I spend an awful lot of hours in the lab. I won't say how many, because this will scare away all people from studying physics. But if I don't do anything in between, then those hours spent in the lab will not be productive after 2 weeks, I can guarantee. I can work a lot for 2 weeks, but then I have to do other stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what are you doing extra? I remember that you were actually taking flying lessons.
Yes, I'm still doing this.
Innsbruck is, of course, a great place to do that.
Innsbruck is amazing, and also Heidelberg is actually quite nice. Yeah, and I mean, I studied in Innsbruck, and some of the hobbies you pick up in Innsbruck just stick. So unfortunately, now skiing is a bit more difficult than it was during doing my bachelor's, so I have to go somewhere. This is a bit annoying. But what I'm still doing a lot is mountain biking, which actually also works quite nicely in Heidelberg. You just have to go up and down the mountain, which is not really a mountain, a bit more often. And which is apparently that's the most common physics hobby. I'm doing a lot of bouldering, so climbing.
Okay, but no more flying.
Still flying.
Gliders, or are you going for pilot slicing?
Nah. I don't want to fly anything with engines. That's boring.
She's a purist.
Pure physics, pure flying. No, yeah. So and I think without this outlet, without going like bouldering once a week and maybe also swimming once a week, you can't work as much as I usually do.
I see. Yeah. Can you explain, I mean, you tried to do this already before, but can you explain very basically, what are you actually now researching
in PhD
to someone who is not into quantum physics? So you've got to be creative with your analogies here.
I guess. It's always, I mean, it's good because if you can take a good analogy, then you have already understood a lot, is what my boss always says, but it's still difficult. It's only, if quantum physicists are listening, it's only working up to a point. Please don't hit me because it's not working fully. So what we are looking at is somehow the emergence of phenomena that you see when you have many particles. And I already talked to Mr. Kim before, and what my analogy always is if you go to a desert and you want to somehow see how, if now wind blows through the desert, how you see shapes in the desert and stuff like this, you can somehow calculate this. Physicists can calculate this. I can't. Theoretical physicists can calculate this. I really can't. But it's somehow easy, so you can somehow model it and everything's fine. If you have like a single grain of sand and you then again take your wind, and then you can also somehow calculate what your piece of sand will do. But if you now have not enough grains of sand to fill a desert and not a single one anymore, then it gets complicated. If you now put like 3 grains of sand or 10 or whatever, you can't describe it. You can't ignore the fact that you have single grains of sand, which you definitely can do in a desert, but you also can't say, okay, it's a single grain of sand, I can calculate everything. And this is somehow, that's somehow the classical analogy to what we are looking at, is somehow, okay, at what point can I describe grains of sand as a desert? So how many grains of sand do I need? Is it 100? Is it 1,000? Is it
so
a million?
In other words, the sand dunes in a desert?
Yes.
How many grains of sand do I need to describe an emergent phenomenon like a sand dune?
Exactly. Uh-huh. And yeah, this is something that we are quite strongly interested in. And of course, this is not a strong border, so it will not be at exactly 1,000. But it's somehow then going more and more and more in this direction of being a sand dune. And it's also somehow, interestingly, it's different for different phenomena. So what we see is that for some phenomena, we are content with having like 10 atoms. With others, we would need 20 atoms, and this is somehow the...
With the difference that you're not talking about sand grains, but each sand grain represents atoms.
Exactly. So we don't have sand grains. We're now going back to the quantum picture again. We really have single atoms. We can prepare single atoms somewhat deterministically, so we can really prepare exact states of 5 plus 5 atoms, 6 plus 6 atoms, etc., and then take images, and that's also the quite nice part, by just illuminating them with laser beams until they...
Let me be clear about this. Taking pictures of individual atoms.
Yes.
So, of course, we have atomic force microscopes.
Yes, but this is not what we are using. So we're having them in free space. We didn't capture them anywhere. They are just flying around. And we take 2 laser beams, shine them exactly on the atom, and then the atom will just throw out photons if we hit the right frequency of the atom, which is just an internal frequency that it has. And it will just basically throw out light. Then we get roughly 320 photons, so elementary particles of light. That's not a lot. That's really not a lot. We can get from this atom. Then through all of our imaging, and so we have a microscope and objective and stuff like this, there we lose most of these atoms. So in the end, we end up with like 20 photons on our camera per atom, which is even less than 320, and 320 was not a lot to begin with. And then with this 20 atoms we detect on our camera, we can then exactly say where the atom was at the time when we took the picture. And now we can either say, okay, we just let it fly freely for a defined time and then take our picture, then the picture basically tells us what speed the atom had, or we just take a picture somewhat instantly and then we can know where the atom was. So we can't have full information about both, but we can either look at the real space, so the position of the atoms, or the speed of the atoms.
So, okay, I'm gonna challenge you now with something. This, it cannot get any more specific. Okay, there are a handful of people worldwide that understand what you're talking about. Very specific. You like what you're doing. In school, we gave you biology lessons, chemistry lessons, physics lessons, history lessons, geography lessons, psychology lessons, math, of course, music, arts, all the full spectrum, sports. Was this all a waste of time for you?
Nah. Really not. I think you have to get the full spectrum to then be able to focus down. And also, you have to talk about different... I mean, I can't talk about quantum physics all day. And I also know a lot of people who, for example, went to a very specialized school who did, for example, one of the HTLs that you were mentioning before. And they then started, during university, they started reading literature, they started looking into music, because they are somehow missing this full picture that you somehow, yeah, that you somehow need. I mean... Yes, for my work, if I would just nail my being a person down to what I do at work, yes, you could have just trained me in physics for 10 years, but I don't know if this would have made me somehow well-rounded or interesting to talk to person, because then I could only talk about very, very, very specific quantum physics stuff.
I think that is the important thing about a general education school is you can talk to more different people about different topics.
Yes.
Yeah. I've got friends with all sorts of different backgrounds, and of course you want a small talk and you want to talk, and there are always certain topics that at least you can connect to with other people. I think that's an aspect that's often forgotten. People always ask, or often ask, what do I need this for? You know, you always want to make the learning and the personal development contingent or dependent on some kind of a usability.
Yeah. But, I mean, that refers back to what I was saying before. The content you often don't need, but the techniques that you learn while learning the content is actually the interesting or the important part that you need later on in life.
Mm-hmm. Well, were there any difficulties that you had when you actually moved from school to university? Difficulties, I'm not talking so much academic issues, but things that kind of surprised you, or where you were stretched a little bit?
I mean, it's quite a different life, because you have to somehow get your timetable yourself, you have to get this in order yourself, you also move out of your home, so you at the same time have to take care that you don't starve, while also being occupied with physics, so this is maybe
get the household done on your own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this was maybe, so this in the beginning was a bit the stressful part, that you really have to take care of everything yourself suddenly. So, I mean, okay, maybe I was just not the most dependent on my parents person in my life in the world, but still you have some sort of you get home and everything is somehow, you have food in the fridge and everything is clean, and this then you suddenly have to take care of yourself and you have to organize the stuff yourself. So maybe this transition is maybe a bit of the more of the most stressful.
Are you living in a Studentenheim, or?
I was living back in Innsbruck. I was living in a student dorm. Yeah.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
I need to ask a question, because this is quite interesting what you've just mentioned. So, would it be a possibility, for example, to have CAS activities that would tie into this need of being more practical when you finish school? You know, how to open an account, or how to kind of work out, or what it takes to live a healthy life, and so on. Well, would that, could that be provided with the lessons as such, or to a change of curriculum, or an additional IB subject? Who knows?
Yeah, may I add to this? It's interesting because a few years ago, it was in Germany. There was a student about graduating and said, and she criticized, I can analyze a poem in four different languages, but I'm still not able to open a bank account or something like that. Yes. And it sparked a huge, basically political debate on the usefulness of the things that you learn in school. And the question is do we as a general education school, which focuses on me as a biology teacher, talk about the cell? Let's face it, how many times are we in everyday life exposed to cells? You know?
Every day.
Every day. Yeah. Yes. Mrs. Artsmiller said every day. Yeah. I always say, I challenge my students. I mean, human beings have around for what, 100,000 years now, and they didn't know what they're made of. And they didn't care. They had other problems. One of our former teachers said, yeah, it's all very interesting, quantum physics. Happened to be a physicist who said that. But we still have to stand up Monday morning. So how does this actually change my everyday experience? Or everyone's saying the universe is expanding, but I still have a problem finding a parking space in the morning. So how does the how would you actually see the very abstract things that you learned at university, that you basically, you cannot talk so easily to other people about that who don't have this background? How do you make this connection to your everyday life? Or is it possible for you to keep it separate? Or do you think about quantum mechanics when you look at the microphone here and think about the quantum phenomena that happen on an, I don't know, electronic level? How does the study of physics or of school or of the subject, how has this influenced your perception, your philosophical perception maybe of life and of our environment? Again, I gotta ask this as a TOK teacher, you know?
maybe starting at Mrs. Steinhaus's question, I think that somehow, I don't know, this life lessons, you at one point somehow, anyway, you are forced to learn it. I mean, some people apparently are not, because some people still cook crap every day and they don't know how they survive, but they do. So maybe there sometimes it would be good to have, like, I don't know, cooking lessons in biology or something like this. I don't know. So also to learn how to keep your cells alive and not only learn how they look like. But I guess that people, anyway, so you at one point have to learn it. Maybe it would be good to learn it a bit earlier in school. So yes, this could be something that's quite interesting. To the TUK part, so I myself, I'm somehow sometimes distancing myself from looking at everything quantum mechanically because it gets annoying. I can't think about quantum physics all day long. My boss, for example, is a bit different. He looks at everything and thinks about how it can be applied in the lab. So he looks at the printer and is like, but this thing is fast. Can't we basically take out this thing out of the printer and then build it into our experiment, because they do it commercially, so they can do it much better than we could ever do it. And that's why we have a lot of crazy ideas lying around. This is something that I admire quite a lot in my professor, so in my PhD supervisor, but that's something that I start doing now because I see this influence, but I tend to sometimes purposefully avoid thinking about physics too much in my free time, because I need to, I'm thinking about physics for 10 hours a day.
Now put words into your mouth, you want to retain your sanity.
Yes.
To a certain extent.
Yes.
What would have been helpful for you for the first months at university that you haven't learned at school?
I'm not quite certain whether you can really prepare students for this first month at university, because then it's also, you're then full with your lectures because they are quite tedious and you're only doing physics all day long, which is also something that you're not used to, or biology or whatever. And then the experience of running around a supermarket while not being super focused because you're still somehow in your lecture with your mind. This is something I don't think that you can really prepare people for this. They have to, and this is, I think this is maybe also the part of growing up that you do at university, because I think that quite a substantial part of growing up is not done while being in school, but it's done afterwards. So I don't think that people that do the matura are full grown-ups?
Well, to that students interact in school a lot more, where they have spaces to communicate or to kind of, yeah, whatever is necessary. Cook together, for example, or, you know.
In other words, I think I get the point quite well. I mean, we're in school so focused on completing the matura, the IB diploma, passing exams, writing the internal assessments. But actually what you need later on in life is also the ability of this emotional intelligence aspect. Mm. I mean, even you as a physicist are working in a team together.
Yes.
You're exposed to different personalities. Mm. You might get along with your boss better or worse sometimes, or colleagues. And are we as a school preparing students enough also for this aspect?
I think yes. I think that, I mean, there's quite a lot of teamwork that you also do in school during the IB, when you work together, when you discuss things together. And I think this is really, I fully agree, this is one of the most important skills for every, I mean, maybe if you're like a super mathematician and you sit in your room alone all day, then you don't need this skill. But everyone else, I think, needs the skill to be able to work and communicate with others and not go crazy while doing it, and not make others crazy while doing it, because these are the most annoying people ever. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think this working together part is really also, but I think, so at least from my experience, this was also done quite a lot in school, that you really had to do tasks together.
You were quite fortunate because you didn't have the COVID period.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes,
because
yes,
that really was missed with us students at the moment. Yeah. That they missed 2 years of socializing. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. The last couple of years with COVID were quite difficult for some students.
Yes.
Some students really benefited from this, from the distance learning, because all of a sudden they could focus on that. They had the ability to study on their own. They could focus on the things that they actually were interested in. Yeah. Others really had a quite a big struggle. Yeah,
I can imagine it. I also realized, because I was doing some teaching at university where I was then doing Zoom courses, and this, it's just not the same as really doing like in presence learning with students at university.
Joining us now on the table is Ms. Brown. She's also a quantum physicist, one of our physics teachers. Now, Sandra is studying currently for a PhD program in Heidelberg.
Hey.
Yeah, and she talked a little bit about graduated in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, there was no physics standard level, high level, but she took chemistry. And she now tried to explain to us what she's kind of... researching.
I missed it. No.
No, because Mrs. Brown is also a quantum physicist, and you told me that you did a lot of computer simulations.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't really simulations; it was more calculations using the computer. We programmed the computer to do these really long calculations that would have otherwise taken, I don't know how long. It took the computer days. So. Yeah, and it was quantum calculations.
Yeah. No, because Sandra is basically trying to explain to us that using an analogy, that she's trying to investigate emergent properties on individual atoms. So, for example, how do, I don't know, multiple atoms behave collectively, and how can you describe that?
Wow.
So basically, the analogy being individual sand grains, how do they translate into the concept of a desert where you have sand dunes as a new property? Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And they do that apparently by shining lasers on the individual atoms. So
do you find that there's a fractal situation, that the individual properties of the atoms kind of can be seen on a larger scale?
So we are working with fermions, which are quite interesting if you go down to the very, very, very basic level and you look at your atoms, you either have bosons, which quite easily are very social, and they just, if you have one boson, you'll have the next one there and the next one and the next one and the next one. We are working with fermions, this is the other kind of atoms, they don't do this. So if one fermion is there, another one won't go there. And this is, of course, something that you see quite long. If you have a lot of fermions and this behavior is not as strongly there, but if you have a few of them, then you quite strongly see that they actually don't like to sit on top of each other. And you can really see this, that they will completely avoid each other if you don't force them to do anything else.
I mean, as a TOK teacher, one of the things that fascinates me also, and because we also have Mr. Funk here as our math teacher, is that in math, you're able to calculate things and you have certain solutions to equations which might not necessarily exist in real life. You have to actually do an experimental verification that the equations of quantum mechanics, of relativity, because theoretically, apparently, according to the equations of physics, you can travel faster than the speed of light and do all these crazy things, but it simply is not seen in real life. And that's one of the things that kind of fascinates me a little bit, is this interaction between experimental sciences and the ability of mathematics to predict or not predict certain phenomena.
I mean, we are working, my group is working in a quite interesting regime where the prediction with math or like also theoretical physics just doesn't work anymore because it's computationally going crazy and that's also then where this, so what we are doing is somehow referred to also as quantum simulation, because the idea is somehow you can't, with a classical computer, you can't predict a quantum system. It's just too complicated. So you need a quantum computer to do quantum physics. And this is also somehow something that we're working on. And this is also, I mean, this is what's fascinating for me, because I mean, it's also nice to have the theory prediction and to measure this and to confirm it exactly, but to really sit in the realm where the theory predictions just completely fail and the theoreticians are like, I could calculate it if you give me 2 years and I have this computer running for 2 years, then I maybe could give you a result. And I think that's actually the interesting part, to sit somewhere where theory just it doesn't fail, but it just not really worthwhile to calculate anything there.
Yeah, Mrs. Brown is nodding, not shaking her head, but nodding.
Yeah, she's just thinking as well that theory is only good as far as it's actually useful, and there are limits to that, and I guess this is a good demonstration of that sometimes you can have a theory and it can be a fascinating theory, but you can't really tell how useful it is, and then it's kind of, it remains in the realm of abstract maths.
I mean, I got a background in molecular biology before I started to become a teacher, microbiology, molecular biology. And I remember that time, big debate always in the scientific community at the university is, applied or pure? And this was a thing, so to say. In our institute, we only do pure science. If you want to do something applied, you're wrong. So please go away, almost, you know. This was kind of this philosophy or culture, almost, everything that was a little bit applied, or went into some kind of a practical direction, and go to the boku if you want to do something applied, you know. We're the pure scientists here, kind of, almost a little bit a form of an arrogance could be felt here. How is this actually in your institute, or is this not even an issue so much? The question of whether research is useful or is applicable?
I mean, we are doing quite fundamental physics, so this is really... And I think the hope is always there that at one point it's something that will be useful. And you also see it with the master students, for example. Some of them are like, yes, I liked what I was doing during my master thesis, but I want to now move on to something that's actually applicable and useful. But somehow also with this fundamental physics, and that's, I think, also always the funding debate of why do I fund fundamental physics? Yeah, why do I pump like literally millions of euros into this stuff? And there, I think the idea is always, well, on the one hand, you never know what comes out. So, I mean, what we are also looking at is somehow the basis of superconductivity. And if we would figure this out completely, then we would solve a lot of problems, because then we would lose significantly less power over power grids, for example. This would be super useful to humanity, but you have to take the baby steps and understand it first before you can then build crazy power lines that are superconducting. And on the other hand, there's also always a lot of things that basically fall off. If you let people just do fundamental physics and they have to develop their own methods and stuff like this, or own instruments, because it's just cutting edge and no one is doing it, then this is also sometimes useful for the general public. I think the most important example of this is actually the GPS, which now everyone has on their phone, but the very basic for the GPS is actually the atomic clock, which is super fundamental physics, but you need to have an accurate time source to be really able to tell your GPS where you are. So this is something that's just basically fallen off of quantum physics or fundamental physics, but it's now super useful to everyone. But I think no one would have really predicted that looking at some hyper fine transitions in rubidium is useful for the general public.
When you said, okay, well, there are so many absurd things, on the other hand, something simple as the atomic clock made it possible to find your way around digitally. So are there any other projects at the moment that might go into the same direction that you can pin down, or any other examples that are as astonishing as the one you've mentioned?
I mean, I have to admit, the atomic clock is always the go-to example. If you have to do advertisement for what you're doing, you can always say, but the atomic clock, we are useful, give us money. I think it's a bit hard to pin down. Where they, I think, are strongly going in a direction where it could be useful quite soon is with all of this quantum computation stuff, where you could then really, for example, predict molecular reactions that you can't predict right now by just simulating it with a quantum computer. I mean, this is then something that's at the moment maybe still some way to go, but I think this is going in the direction that could have really, really useful applications for the general public.
So also for the problems we have to solve in connection with climate change, can you think of something?
I mean, it's always a bit hard to estimate what impacts it will then in the end have, because you don't know what the limitations will, you know what limitations there are currently, you don't know what of those limitations will be overcome in the future or in the near future. But I think if you could, I mean, some of the projects are, for example, to then be able to accurately look at, as I said, like molecular structure, and then also to have like fertilizer developments, and this improved, and this could then be, I mean, this is also now again one of these poster board advertisements for fundamental physics now, but this is also somehow in the direction that you can then think of, that this world could then be improved because you could basically look at the reactions that those molecules in a fertilizer have with much more accuracy.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you said you didn't do IB physics, so maybe not so... I mean, you must have done core physics, though, right?
Yes.
Because I'm just wondering if you compare what you were learning in school with what you know now and think about the connections. Like, can you think of any ways that we could sort of show the students what the possibilities are and where it really goes when you get into these things? Because I think there's loads of students who are really fascinated by what they've heard about quantum mechanics, but it never links in with actually what they learn. And I don't know. I think it would be amazing to make those connections.
This is now because I find my job quite interesting, but I think one of the things that really becomes quite fascinating quite fast is that we can look at individual atoms, so we can really resolve them and we can look at them. So this field of cold atoms is maybe a bit of an absurd one, but it's also something that's very visual because you can just take pictures of it. And I think this so at least for me, this visualization of these effects is really something that's tremendously helpful to also like gain a more in-depth understanding. But it's of course, I mean,
we don't have the possibility to do that experiment at school.
No,
right?
No. But you could like maybe show results or something like this. I mean, this is. But otherwise, it's of course a bit difficult because the understanding that you need to really thoroughly understand quantum mechanics is quite, so you need a lot of math and if you find good analogies and if you stay maybe more on shallow on this, like, also the things that like are like, that are in these general interest books about quantum mechanics. I mean, these are also super interesting, and they are not so wrong if you take them. If you also go deeper, they are still not completely wrong. And I think this is maybe the level that you should then keep to and keep the interest of students. And of course, I think it's also something that's quite interesting that the daily life of a physicist is, of course, not doing calculations all day. At least if you're doing experimental physics like I'm doing, then it's a lot of tinkering all day. So So this week I spent like 2 days trying to fix an air conditioning unit because it broke. This is also, I mean, this is maybe not the most fun part of my job, but it's also part of my job, and that's what makes it so interesting, that you also have to, I do some soldering and I do some programming and I do some cleaning up.
Practical work.
Yes, it's quite practical actually.
Are there any projects to sort of share your findings with the sort of general public?
So what we did quite recently was one of these Girls' Day projects, where you could then really, and this was even a remote Girls' Day project, because it was still, so it was this winter, so we then just basically sent out packages to girls, and then we did a Zoom call and looked at polarization, actually, so how different fluids change the polarization of light with them, and this was something that's was I think quite fascinating for the students. And I mean, it's now a bit far because it's the University of Heidelberg and not the University of Linz, but we are also doing an awful lot of lab tours, for example, for students, and I think this is maybe also something that could be done at the University of Linz. When I was in school, we did a nanotechnologie Woche at the University of Linz, where like 5 or 6 interested students could really visit one research group a day for a week, and this was something that was super nice because you see them.
Because you had Mr. Sitter, right?
No, this was from, because I was doing physikalische Übungen as a electronic subject in the afternoon, and this there you then had the possibility to do this, and this was really fascinating because you could also go to the clean room and to look
that
at the,
would be cool.
The glove boxes in the lab
object, you know,
maybe
yeah
it's maybe worth finding out what whether they have anything like that on offer at the university.
That would be really nice, yeah, to see hands-on how it's done, and even how they repair an air conditioner, you know, so that they see the real life.
Yeah,
so
I mean, we are doing for like, so the University of Heidelberg has quite a lot of like students' days and stuff like this, where you then really do lab tours for high school students, and I mean, you have to break it down a bit, but I think it's still quite fascinating to see these experiments real life, that because they're also significantly more complex than any experiments you do at school, of course. But it's quite fascinating, I would say.
Yeah, it sounds it. It sounds very interesting. And what you're saying about actually being able to resolve atoms, I think that's something which would fascinate the students, to actually be able to see that, because it's not something you see every day, right?
I can provide you with live images. I mean, it's just dots in the end, but it's... I sometimes forget myself how fascinating it is, because I'm used to it. I'm sitting in front of this computer and staring at these 5+5 atoms, so sometimes I have to remind myself that actually what I'm doing there is quite astonishing if you...
Yeah, very unique. It's not a view that most people get.
Yes, and for me it's like...
How many students would get what's going on?
But it depends if they're interested. I mean, I think actually they would be interested if they could make a connection that this is something real and it has an effect on their lives, and it's like getting at how things work, and you can actually see atoms. And if you could sort of make those connections with them, but often without a real person or a real sort of example of how it applies to them, they don't make the connection, and then they're not interested. Any possibilities there are worth thinking about.
Yeah. We're just at the topic of how to get students excited about quantum physics. Or
look, I'll give you a very... I've been thinking about stuff like this, not specifically about quantum physics, but... as a biology teacher, it's easier maybe, because it's easier to... I start off totally differently. You see, when you go online on YouTube, you find a lot of videos on astronomy, watching stars, telescopes, space travel. It's all there, well covered. Lots of amateur astronomers out there. Some folks are measuring out the movement of certain asteroids, and they enter it into the database, and then they're happy that they made a new discovery. Yeah. There is this fundamentally positive attitude
Yeah. Nature exploration, you know, with me, with my microscopy channel, lots of folks, wow, it's cool, nature and natural science and so on. So there is a fundamental interest there in a lot of topics. And then, as one of my former physics teachers also said, is look at the kids. When they're young and when they go, before they go to school in kindergarten, they ask questions like crazy. And as soon as they're in elementary school, they stop asking. So somehow, are we doing something wrong as teachers? I'm deliberately trying to provoke here now. Huh? And I sometimes feel that in the context of an education system in a classroom setting, where I've got 30 students sitting in front of me, it's really difficult to pass on this excitement for your subject where I have in the background, I have to have tests, I have to assess them. Yeah, I want to do something practical. I don't have 30 microscopes.
Yeah.
You see, we try our best, of course, but sometimes I feel that the setting, simply an educational setting, simply cannot allow you to,
That's why you have to go outside a lot and do excursions and go to the lab and kind of hands-on, learning. Not so much at school. I think we need to go out a lot more.
Yeah, we need to go out a lot more, which is, of course, also, again, the practical difficulties with that. But I think, and that's also one of the reasons why we like to invite. Also, last week we had former students who graduated. I think it's really important that the students get a little bit of perspective of beyond the IB and the Matura.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like the focus point, and there's so much afterwards. Yeah. Yeah. So, but how do you get folks interested in quantum physics?
I mean, I was just thinking that a lot of the physics we teach is this, because you were just saying earlier about how our theories are only useful as far as they're actually useful. And like Newtonian mechanics and our classical physics, we've reached the sort of boundary of its usefulness. And we want to go beyond that now. And I think the kids are excited about the beyond that, because that's the place where all the interest is. But it's like, in order to get there, the way it was learned historically is through all this classical stuff. And that is actually still the basis of a lot of what we do. But it feels very boring and long-winded to the students, and until they get to that beyond where they can stand on the edge and look and see that there's something of interest there, there's no motivation to do all this old stuff, which
I totally agree with you, but I'm challenging you now with another thing, and maybe Sandra can also give her opinion on this. I mean, one way of teaching, of course, physics and the natural sciences, this is a very teacher-centered approach, right? And for some students, this is really what they want. They want to look up to the teacher. Wow, how much does he or she know? And then it's also fascinating. And then, of course, you have the other extreme, where essentially the teacher is only a moderator and the students should do their own research and make a nice poster. So this kind of this two extreme views, you know, and then sometimes we get the feedback, well, if you do too much of this open type of learning, it also stresses out students, because actually some of them, they want to know the facts, they just want to be taught, and they don't want to always go out. So it's kind of these two extremes somehow.
I think you need a good basis before you can venture out into your own stuff. So you have to somehow start with really knowing your facts and knowing what you want to research. So I think if you have a topic and you want to spend 4 lessons on it, you should at least spend 2 with really looking at the facts, and then you can take 2 more, now just numbers, but then you can take a few more and let the kids like investigate it themselves. But if they have no idea what they are looking at, then also investigating themselves will be... it doesn't make sense, because then they would take forever to learn the stuff that's just the basic fundamentals. This will eat up the entire 4 hours, and they will never get to the point where it's actually super interesting, and you could speed up the process of these 4 hours significantly. And I think there you really have to find the balance somehow between...
Yeah.
Also, I mean, if I get now bachelor or master students in the lab, you also... again, always have to find the balance between what do you teach them and what do they have to learn themselves, and where do you... Because, I mean, probably it would be faster if I would do everything myself. I mean, this is now also because it's more practical content, but So you can't take away all of the learning from them, but somehow some things you can just speed up a bit because you don't want them to spend forever on something that's maybe
not
interesting.
not very satisfying for
all
students.
Exactly.
Yeah, what we've seen. Yeah. So, and this is, I think, also one of the challenges a little bit is how do you make it interesting? You see, it's so much depends a little bit also on the expectations of the students, you know. For some students, I mean, there have been lectures just fully teacher-centered and it was totally theoretical, and some students loved it. And as soon as you do something practical, you know, just tell us the facts, you know, because then essentially the time is better spent, at least in the view of the students, yeah. So it's also, I think, a different personalities of students and also different expectations of what students actually have, yeah.
But I think there the university system of really having lectures where you really have the fact-centered, where you have one person mm-hmm. standing in front and preaching you the facts, basically, and then having complementary, like, practical courses mm-hmm. or doing calculation courses or whatever is really something that I quite enjoy because you get the facts hammered in the morning and then you can try to get it yourself in the afternoon.
So great to see you.
Really. Yeah, it was super nice. Yeah.
For your further life and studies and I hope you have a very happy end.
Come on, don't stop!
A very happy and fulfilling future in front of you.
Yeah.
It's quite fun at the moment. Good for you. That's good for you. Yeah, but maybe you can sort of make a connection here because I guess Rose would be happy to be on the pulse of science and research.
Yeah, I am fascinated to see some of these pictures that you've got of atoms.
All the best. Bye.
So, of course, 50% of all of my photos on my phone are left pictures, but it's actually quite underwhelming if you look at it. But each of these white points is actually an atom. This one,
wow.
And this one, and this one, and this one, and this one, and also these ones down there.
So and where are the ones?
Are they carbon?
Lithium.
Lithium.
Okay. And are they electrons? What are the little dots?
The little dot. So the white dots, this white thingy here mm-hmm. is basically the light that you gather from one individual atom.
So that's one atom,
yes,
and that's one
that's
atom.
That's another one, and that's another one, and so that's another one, and that's another
they're
one.
They're not very evenly spread, are they?
Are they the ones that don't like each other? Or
they're the ones that don't like each other. And they, yeah, you only see the structure. So if you take a lot of these shots, you see that they are actually sorted. But you, of course, it's like drawing from a probability distribution randomly 5 times, and then you just mm-hmm. get, in each shot, you get just random. Positions.
So how many? I mean, you said when you look at sand, how many are there? Is this like a dune or is this kind of just...
So, at least for the property that we're looking at right now, these 5 plus 5 are already starting to be a dune and not a sand grain
okay,
anymore.
Okay, cool.
Okay, well, thank you so much. That's very interesting. Okay, I gotta go.
And have you published any of these results?
Yes, so we've now, like 2 weeks ago, we have published, so the first paper where my name is also on it, we've published it in Nature, so it's quite nice.
Cool. You have to send a link.
Yes, I can do this.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, Nature is one of the science magazine with one of the highest prestige, right? So the impact factor is...
I don't know it often,
but
it's
quite high.
It's quite high, yeah.
Yeah.
And you get an author's copy, so I have the printed version of it. It's quite nice.
Yeah.
That's cool. Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Yeah. Well,
the conversation was not over yet, because we decided to exchange a few words in German as well.
Eine Sprachenschule, kann ich denn überhaupt Physik studieren?
Yeah.
Das ist schon irgendwie immer so ein großer Punkt, aber das ist halt eigentlich...
Ja, ja eben, ja. Man muss sich auf der Universität ohnehin wieder komplett neu orientieren.
Genau, genau. Und dann ist es komplett egal, was man davor gemacht hat. Also,
ja.
Ist sogar cool, wenn man ein paar Sprachen kann. Und dass man Englisch kann, braucht man sowieso ständig. Also.
Ja, natürlich, in der Naturwissenschaft geht es ohne Englisch ohnehin nicht. Wird eigentlich in Innsbruck oder in Heidelberg, was ist denn da die Institutssprache? Einige Uni-Institute sind ja komplett auf Englisch umgestiegen schon.
Also Unterrichtssprache im Bachelor ist großteils Deutsch, außer bei manchen Profs, die halt stur sind und dann auf Englisch unterrichten. Master ist komplett auf Englisch und institutsmäßig kommt es ein bisschen auf die Arbeitsgruppen drauf an, aber wir reden eigentlich den ganzen Tag Englisch. Also wir reden auch unter Leuten, die jetzt aus, keine Ahnung, Deutschland und Österreich kommen, reden wir Okay, es ist so ein Lisa-Denglisch schon wieder. Man redet genauso, wie man hier am Gang redet. Es ist so eine Mischung aus Deutsch und Englisch. Weil das Problem ist, man kann nicht über Physik reden auf Deutsch. Es klingt alles furchtbar, man hat die Fachbegriffe gar nicht. Also die Hälfte der Fachbegriffe, keine Ahnung, was das auf Deutsch heißt. Und dann redet man das halt auf Englisch und dann switcht man da wieder so. Es ist wirklich wie in der Lisa am Gang, dass man dann irgendwie dreimal am Tag Sprache ändert und es fällt einem gar nicht auf.
Und wie schaut das aus für die Leute, die jetzt, sage ich mal so, aus deutschsprachigen AHS kommen und dann Physik studieren und vielleicht jetzt nicht diesen starken sprachlichen Hintergrund haben? Die lernen es dann halt. Oder sind gezwungen, es zu lernen.
Die sind gezwungen, es zu lernen, ja. Und das ist, glaube ich, schon auch ein bisschen, ich glaube, da gibt es eine Übergangsperiode, wo das sicher auch hart ist, das Ganze, weil du musst halt dann irgendwann mal im Studium, neben dem ganzen Physikzeug, das du machst, auch den Sprachübergang irgendwann schaffen, weil das ist wieder, ist halt Uni, da nimmt dich keiner an der Hand und redet dann eine halbe Unterrichtsstunde Deutsch und eine halbe Unterrichtsstunde Englisch mit dir, sondern dann ist es halt jetzt auf Englisch.
Ja, ich frag deshalb, weil immer wieder Fragen kommen von Eltern, interessierten Eltern, sagt, ja, das ist ja alles ganz cool und nett an der Lisa, dass da jetzt da auf Englisch unterrichtet wird, verlernen meine Kinder nicht das Deutsch dadurch. Das ist immer diese Befürchtung und tun sie sich dann auf der Universität schwer. Und unsere Standardantwort ist ja, man braucht sehr viel Englisch auf der Universität.
Ja,
das ist auch ein Vorteil. Und dass man Deutsch nicht verlernt, ich glaube, das sehen wir alleine da schon, dass die Leute bei uns die österreichische Matura machen auf Deutsch und
Ja, also es ist ja, ich habe jetzt kein Wort Deutsch verlernt, während ich in der Lisa war. Ja. Es ist halt, manchmal ist es ein bisschen Denglisch, aber ich kann jetzt auch normal Deutsch reden, wenn ich normal Deutsch reden will.
Ja, aber das sind eben auch Befürchtungen, natürlich legitime Befürchtungen, aber die tauchen halt immer wieder auf. Ja, wie schaut das aus mit den, ja, aber ja, ich, selbst wie ich damals eben Mikrobiologie studiert habe, da war eben extrem viel auf Englisch. Die ganzen Lehrbücher, nichts mehr übersetzt worden, weil sich einfach viel zu schnell die wissenschaftliche Welt ändert. Bis man die Bücher übersetzt hat, ist das eh schon wieder veraltet.
Ja, und die Professoren sind halt auch aus Amerika, aus Italien, aus whatever. Und manche davon halten deutsche Vorlesungen, aber manche sagen dann halt auch...
Machen wir es vielleicht eh besser, wenn es auf Englisch ist, ja, weil ist dann ist man gleich, dann bleibt man gleich in der Wissenschaftssprache, die ganzen Begriffe.
Genau.
Bin mir nicht einmal sicher, ob es überhaupt Übersetzungen gibt von diesen ganzen Fachbegriffen.
Ja, das Lustige ist, dass in Physik sehr viele tatsächlich dann deutsche Begriffe eingeenglischt wurden, weil sehr vieles von diesen urphysikalischen Begriffen so, Einstein etc. auf Deutsch kreiert wurden und dann redet man eh irgendwie Deutsch, aber mit englischer Aussprache. Also das ist ja ganz lustig, dass ja tatsächlich früher die Physiksprache Deutsch war.
Und seit dieser Zeit, historisch gesehen, gibt es eben noch Begriffe, die jetzt dann ins Englische übernommen worden sind.
Genau.
Interessant.
Eigenzustand ist ein Eigenstate.
Ein Eigenzustand ist ein Eigenstate.
Ein Eigenstate, ja.
Aha.
Und dann redet man den ganzen Tag eh halb Deutsch, aber das komplett auf Deutsch, Eigenzustand klingt wieder furchtbar, aber Eigenstate ist ganz normal.
Okay, interessant. Ja, ich meine, auch in der Biologie gibt es ja solche Sachen, wo man verkrampft versucht, gewisse Dinge einzudeutschen, die man aber nicht... Desoxyribonukleinsäure, das ist der eingedeutschte Begriff, aber eigentlich in der Naturwissenschaft sagt man, auch wenn man auf Deutsch redet, immer nur DNA, Deoxyribonucleic Acid. Ja. Also manchmal wird krampfhaft versucht, Dinge einzudeutschen, die man nicht einmal in der Naturwissenschaft dann so verwendet.
Genau, bei der Physik ist es genau umgekehrt, da ist unglaublich viel noch Deutsch. Also so.
Ah, interessant, ja. Ja. Auf jeden Fall herzlichen Dank.
Gerne.
Und freut mich, dass du da warst.
Ja, mich auch.
So, well, thank you again, Sandra. It was very informative. It was really a great enjoyment for us all to have you back at our school. It's always a nice thing when former students visit us. It actually shows that there is still a certain emotional connection to our school. And of course, this makes us quite happy. Well, for today, that's all I want to say. I wish you all the best. If you're also an alumni and a former student, then please do visit us as well. And yes, I promise that I'll also interview you. Okay, so long and bye-bye.